So let me continue with the energy transfer. I think it's chapter 4.4 in the lecture notes. You know, you should distinguish carefully between energy equilibrium, which was the previous equation, and the energy transfer, right? Because these are two different things. Essentially, energy transfer equations are usually expressed in terms of dT over dNR, or in our case, I will work to compute dT over dR. But it's very easy to convert this form of equation to this form, of course, because the only thing you have to do is to multiply by dR over dNR, which you already know, because this is the continuity equation. So, energy transfer. So, what are the possibilities? I think there are 6 options. Or 6 means of transfer. And let's start with radiation. Or to be a bit more specific, it's a radiative diffusion. In our case, it's really diffusion because our object is a million kilometers across, and its size is much larger than the mean free path over which a photon can travel across stellar interior. So that in our case, we are almost certainly in the regime of a diffusion of radiation. In my room here, it's not diffusion, of course, because most optical photons will travel easily from one wall to another wall, so we never can describe this radiation as a diffusive process. Another option is convection. Or simply a flow of energy. You can call it a flow if you wish. Or it's a turbulence which occurs in stellar interiors. Turbulence is usually considered essentially a random process, but it's not totally random, right? It has a certain spectrum, it has a certain range of sizes of vortices, so it's really important, works in stellar interiors, and it's one of the unresolved questions, because we do not observe the turbulence directly. We can see something on the surface, because on the surface there are the granuli, you know, the brighter and darker spots. I don't mean the sunspots, but I mean the small size of approximately 1 arc second or 2 arc seconds sized structures, which appear and disappear on a 15-minute time scale. And that's what is called a granulation. And this is essentially the top of a turbulent layer, the very top. But the layer is 200,000 kilometers thick. And practically, we do not know, cannot measure directly this turbulent motion inside stellar interiors. And moreover, I would like to describe it using or avoiding velocities. And that's a problem for me, because I do not want to model individual velocities of bubbles, of whirls, of vortices. So that will be our major task, to approximate turbulence without invoking motions in our model. Number three is conduction. Again, it's a heat diffusion. Occurring in solids, liquids, dense gases, of course, especially in solids, right? Because there is no way how we can convect a solid unless it's a solid convection in earth mantle, right? In terrestrial bodies, the convection is possible on a very long, slow time scale, because real materials do behave as partly solids and partly liquids. And as an outcome, right, you have this sort of mixture of solid and liquid behavior. And then even a solid state convection can be an option. But in our case, in our solids, it's the conduction, especially because the radiation is absorbed in a dense solid. We also have another option, which are neutrinos. Well, this is not normal in normal stars, but at late stages of evolution, it's the major mechanism, a major energy transfer, which has to be accounted for. Otherwise, you would never explain, for example, explosions of supernovae. There's no way without neutrino transfer. You know, these exploding bubbles are essentially heated by neutrinos emitted from the very center and transferred to a so-called neutrino sphere, which is heated by the absorption of neutrinos. Actually, it's essentially similar to photons, right? But it has only a different cross-section and its energy dependence. And semi-finally, we have the waves. But, you know, an infinite wave, I mean, starting at minus infinity and going up to the plus infinity, is useless, because it travels from one side to another side, and energy which is transported is never transformed to heat. It's never used to heat my place right here. So I'm actually interested in waves which are dissipated somewhere, because when a wave dissipates, it stores its kinetic energy and its potential energy into the medium. So just be careful that this is essentially a dissipation we are interested in. First, a creation of waves, and then their dissipation. And let me also warn you that there are many different types of waves which can be present in stellar interiors. Of course, there are the sound waves. And the waves I'm using right now to inform you that kind of thing. So these are density waves, which are essentially parallel to the K vector. Another option are gravity waves, Or let me say, let me describe them. This is the sound wave. Another wave is a gravity wave, but maybe a better name for it is a buoyant wave. And buoyant means that you have a bubble, and then if you move it somewhere upwards, then it moves on its own backwards to the stable position. It may overshoot and go upwards. Something like flying in a balloon, which is going up and down, right? This is the gravity wave, which is driven by the buoyant forces. And buoyant means, again, it's a slight non-equilibrium between the gravity and the pressure gradient, right? Nothing else. So it's essentially a perturbation of the hydrostatic equilibrium. And, you know, these buoyant waves are essentially just the opposite of this turbulence. It's interconnected. Where the turbulence occurs, these buoyant waves are not possible, and vice versa. It's a very important connection. And finally, let me mention the gravitational waves. And then, of course, there are many more waves in solids, many more waves in plasma, in MHD, right? Many quantities can oscillate, and everything can create a wave which can be dissipated somewhere. But let me also mention the gravitational waves. Which can release a huge amount of energies, huge amounts, right? 3 solar masses of the rest energy, which is a huge amount, which can be released in a matter of seconds and carried away from your point of interest. But of course, then it's much harder to embed this energy somewhere else. It's almost impossible, because usually these waves, when they are radiated away as perturbation of the space-time metric, they can travel across our room and nothing can be seen, because they are too weak and they cannot be embedded somewhere easily. But let me also think about other types of gravitational perturbations. For example, tides can be also treated as gravitational perturbations, which can store the energy somewhere. And you take the energy from essentially the orbital energy of satellites or orbital energy of planets orbiting stars. So let me assign these tidal interactions down here. It's the 6th option. I would say that the moon Io orbiting Jupiter is a profound example how you can convert the tidal interaction into heat. It's a very important source of energy inside this body. All right. So let me start discussion of this part, radiation. Co chceš říkat, Lidia?
No,
jasně. Tak, teďka let me continue with the radiative transfer. However, I think it's chapter 441. before we can even start, we have to understand a quantity, which is called the opacity. Usually it's denoted kappa or kappa nu. If you're interested in monochromatic properties of this opacity, or kappa lambda, if it's wavelength dependent. It's usually it's used in the elementary radiative transfer equation. So let me recall the simplest form. RTE, which is a common abbreviation of the radiative transfer equation, which is DI equals to minus kappa rho times I, where DI is a change of the intensity along your line of sight. I is the intensity itself. Rho is the density of your medium, and kappa is the opacity, or let me call it a specific opacity, but I'm not going to use the word specific. Right? It's specific because we divide by the density. So it's clear that you can estimate kappa from observations, for example, in this room or in our atmosphere, as di over I. Well, it's a relative change of intensity, so it's unitless. And 1 over rho. And as an outcome, and of course it's also dependent on dx, which is the length along your line of sight. And so we have to divide by 1 over dx too. And so the unit of kappa, as well as of kappa nu and kappa lambda, is meter squared divided by kilogram, or meter squared times kilogram to minus 1. How could you imagine it, right? Just imagine that you have a medium in front of you, right? Directly in front of you, which is as dense as our air. Well, we are lucky because our air has 1 kilogram per cubic meter. So the value of rho is 1, right? And you should then ask how much radiation is absorbed on 1 meter in this medium. So what's the value of opacity? Is it large or small? What do you think? In this particular case, 1 meter in front of you. Just a moment. I have some problem with this because I cannot hear you. And that's because can you try to speak once again, please?
I think that for air, the opacity is small.
It's small, simply because I can see you very easily, right? If you would be in front of me, I cannot see any change in your appearance. The DI is almost zero, exactly. And then let's have a look out of the window. Right? I don't know if you have a window in front of you, but actually how much radiation what percentage of radiation which is absorbed by our atmosphere I mean, radiation coming from the universe, from stars. Is it a fraction of a percent, 1%, or 10%? How much is it?
I think it depends on the frequency of the radiation.
Oh, sure, perfect, great. But let's take the optical frequencies we are mostly interested in, because we observed at 550 nanometers, plus or minus a few hundred of nanometers.
So given that we see stars at night, I would say that it's not very much.
But let me add, but it's 30%. So it's definitely not negligible. And you can actually see it when you look from the zenith down to the horizon. Right? So just imagine that the thickness of the atmosphere, or the it's the optical thickness, essentially, increases when you go down to the horizon. It's called the air mass. In the vertical direction, the air mass is equal to 1. And as you go downwards to the horizon, it increases up to, let's say, 100 or so. And it's clear that you cannot see stars when they are close or at the horizon. So it has to be a substantial fraction. It's not non-negligible. By the way, once upon a time, I was very lucky, because we observed stars which are just a quarter a degree above the horizon, but using a small binoculars, right? And, it was a very clean air. It was the cleanest air I've ever seen. And the stars were actually below the horizon, because, quarter a degree is less than a refractive angle, which is half a degree usually. So they were actually one quarter a degree below the horizon, and the refraction brought them up to one quarter degree of above the horizon. So it's roughly speaking 30%. So we have this factor, di over over i, which is 0.3 in our atmosphere. 1 over O is 1, simply because we have the air. And what is the thickness of our atmosphere? Mr. Peshta, do you have an estimate? What is the thickness of our atmosphere?
About 100 kilometers.
Well, maybe it's the tenuous part, the so-called upper atmosphere. But when we supply density, which is comparable to our density at zero level, I would say it's only 10 kilometers. Right? And if you integrate the atmosphere from the ground up, you end up with indeed 10 kilometers of air with the unit density. So it's 10 to 4. 10 to minus 4, 1 over the x. And so I would say that the opacity of our atmosphere is of the order of 10 to minus 5 meters squared per kilogram. Right? Okay, so it's a pretty transparent environment. And now let's have a look at the opacity in stellar interiors. Stellar interiors. That's it. So just let me explain the Zhu graph. It's the value of kappa, but in CGS units. So it's in centimeters squared per gram. I think it's a factor of 10, in our equation. Then we have log T in kelvins, and the range is indeed suitable for stars. So it's 10,000 to 100 million Kelvin. And because usually hot stars have different densities than cool stars, it's not density in this y-axis, but it's a combination of rho and t, right? Doesn't matter. The only thing which does matter is that it's a range of quantities which is relevant for stars. And it's huge, right? The opacity has a peak somewhere, and the peak is huge. It's 10 to 6 centimeters square per cran, or I think 10 to 5 meters squared per kilogram. So it's almost opaque material, right? And the reason is very straightforward, right? On the left-hand side of this plot, or let me try to find an interactive version so that we can see all the sides of this view graph. But I have to find it. I think it's somewhere here. I see, that's the plot I'm going to discuss. So as you can see, there are low values of opacity at low temperatures because matter in this state is more or less neutral. It's a neutral gas, which is very stable, very transparent, and it's essentially similar to our air. That's why there is a region of low, very low opacity. And we are quite lucky that we live in an environment which is so transparent and we can observe the universe. On the other hand, on the right-hand side of this plot, there is a fully ionized state, fully ionized. What does it mean? It means that there are free protons, free electrons, and there is no way how they can recombine, right? And so, what about the photons in this case? Photons cannot interact easily with individual protons because they can be only scattered, but they cannot be absorbed because proton cannot absorb anything. It does not have energy levels, right? At least in this range of temperatures. And free electrons are similar. The only way how they can be absorbed or emitted is an Brennstrahlung, which is a motion of electrons around ions, because they move with a non-zero acceleration, and during this motion they can radiate, or they can vice versa absorb such photons. That's why this opacity is so low and why it's flat. It's almost temperature independent because nothing changes in this plasma. Right? Everything is fully ionized. In between, we have a partial ionization. And that's what is the most dangerous part of the opacity dependence. Right? Because opacity is very high, mostly because photons are absorbed by atoms and they have a suitable energy to be absorbed by atoms. At, as you can see, 10,000 to 100,000 Kelvin. This is the range where this ionization and recombination is working. At the same time, excitation and radiative de-excitation works at the same time. And finally, you can during these processes, you essentially create photons by these recombinations and ionizations, which are the same photons which you can use to ionize other atoms. So that's why there is this peak of the opacity. By the way, why it decreases to the right hand side for low densities? I explained the temperature dependence, so that you need a photon which has a suitable energy to be absorbed by an atom. But what about this dependence on the density? Is it somehow logical? You know, definitely it's logical, because the recombination itself is a two-particle process, right? And so during the recombination, it has to be somehow density dependent. And please have a look at the Saha equation we discussed last week, because the Saha equation is, again, very strongly dependent on these densities, right? Density squared, essentially. All right, so this is the opacity dependence. And I have to show another plot or another list, which is also relevant for our purposes. You know, every microscopic process has a certain dependence on parameters, on density and temperature, and hence the opacity will depend on these microscopic processes, right? So let me summarize it very briefly and very quickly. At the highest energies, the most common process is the Compton scattering. It's this one, right? Compton scattering on free electrons. Then we have the Thomson scattering, which is somewhat less energetic, and the wavelength of photons is not changed substantially during this interaction. In magnetic fields, we can have either a synchrotron or cyclotron emission when these electrons behave or move along curved trajectories. So these are these two emission processes. This is the Bremsstrahlung I already mentioned, which is a free emission due to the interaction between positively charged ion, denoted here as Z plus, and a negatively charged electron. And we can also expect free absorptions, which is just the inverse of this process. These are the energies which are already relevant for ionization or partial ionization, right? So the photoionization is this process, very straightforward, but you know, it's again very relevant for the absorption of photons, right? If there is only the photoionization and the inverse process, you would never destroy the photons, but you can, you also have to account for collisional processes, right? For these collisional ionizations, which is the interaction between neutrals and some particles. And these collisional processes always work together with radiative processes. And you can destroy electrons in these collisions or during these collisions. Finally, there are some fine effects like the Auger effect or recombination, three-particle recombination, or d-electronic recombination. So these are some important variants. I think the most important one is this recombination. And finally, we have a list of bound-bound processes which occur during two bound states. You know, atoms have discrete energy levels, and so you can expect some absorption and a change in the electronic state, a spontaneous emission or stimulated emission. And of course, these processes have different dependencies on parameters. So these are the remaining processes. I see. Three more general statements. Atoms and molecules do have not only electronic states, I mean states of the electron, but also vibrational states and rotational states, which are possible when you have molecules. And these transitions are called vibrational or rotational, and they occur on different energies. Usually the vibrational transitions are in infrared or far infrared, and rotational transitions are in radio or very far infrared. So just one correction. I think vibrational transitions should be present also in the near infrared. This is actually the most important transition which occurs in our atmosphere. It's opaque in a near infrared, mostly because of these vibrational transitions in water molecules. There are two scattering processes, or three scattering processes, actually. And the rest, I mean, for the lowest energies, is devoted to interactions of photons and dust particles, or dust grains, as we call them. These occur at much lower temperatures than in stars, with one exception. And these are the envelopes of red giants or asymptotic giant branch stars, which have so extended envelopes and so cold envelopes that dust can be formed in these envelopes. And you know, the opacity of dust is extremely high. So just to complete our figure, right? You have to should imagine that, okay, this is the largest peak due to the partial ionization. There is a very significant decrease, but at lower temperatures, there will be definitely an increase of this temperature, first due to molecules, and then due to formation of dust grains. All right, so that's the list of processes. You know, the opacity is an extremely important function, so that's why I have to discuss it very carefully. And let me move on. Let me move on to describe the stellar interior and the radiation transfer in spherical geometry. It will be probably the last part of today's lecture. Because we have to adapt this simplified or simplest form of the radiative transfer equation to a spherical geometry. So what is going on? I'd like to describe the transfer in a infinitesimally thin spherical shell, but I will zoom into this shell. So let me plot it as thick, thick enough to see the details. Now, for the intensity as a quantity, it's important to specify the governing direction. And the direction in this case is simply the radial direction from the center of the star. And you are mostly interested in transfer along this line of sight. So this is the R, the thickness of our layer, but the transfer can occur in any direction. So let me start with an elementary area, ds, here, and somewhat inclined direction, inclined by the angle of theta. And this is the direction I'm going to study. I'm going to write an equation along this direction. And this is what is usually called dx. And you should specify the value or the intensity, then the energy in this column of gas. Unfortunately, you know, we are slightly somewhere else. And of course, this is a different direction. You have to be very careful. This is a different direction. And this is a slightly different angle, right? It's not the same because we work in a spherical geometry. And luckily, you can compute this change of the original direction, another direction, because this is d theta. That's the angle in the center, and you can easily relate dr and dx because it's on the small triangle here, so that dr is surely equal to dx multiplied by the cosine of theta, right? And this length, or arc length, if you wish, is simply equal to r times d theta. And it should be r d theta equals to dx multiplied by sine theta. Okay. So these are elementary equations describing the geometry of our problem, right? Okay, and now the radiative transfer equation itself. So we are interested in a change of intensity from this point. So it's the intensity in R plus dr. And theta plus d theta, which equals to the original intensity at the point R and theta. We are essentially assuming that it's symmetric in this or along this direction, in the azimuthal direction. It's definitely not symmetric in this direction. The intensity has to change somehow. It cannot be isotropic, because then the energy would not be transferred in stellar interiors. Right? So we have to account for this theta dependence, but I think we can be quite sure that it's more or less azimuthally symmetric, because the microscopic processes which occur in this column are definitely random. And we account for the emission, which is J times rho times dx, and the absorption, which is minus kappa rho times dx. We already discussed kappa rho, but we absorb the radiation, so we have to multiply by I, the intensity, times dx. We already discussed kappa, but we also should mention this emission coefficient. Which is again a potentially complicated function of the state quantities, rho t, as well as the chemical composition, symbolized as x, y, z. But, you know, if we are in an equilibrium situation, this stuff is simpler than the normal, than in general situation. There is a relation between these J coefficients and these kappa coefficients, which is called the Kirchhoff law. And I will use it in the future, in the near future, right? So just let me mention that in an equilibrium situation, J can be computed from kappa if we use the Kirchhoff law. Which is essentially J over kappa equals the source function, and the source function is often approximated as the Planck function, which is then denoted as B. All right, just a clarification that that, you know, the situation here is sometimes much more complicated than in equilibrium, right? Especially because when you have to account for a detailed scattering, like in this room, right? I have many sources in this room, many walls, even some paintings, so that it's very strongly dependent on direction, and it's neither symmetric in azimuth nor symmetric in theta, right, in collatitude, so that in this case the source function, this J, includes scattering, and the scattering source, scattering emission coefficient, is dependent on the intensity in a different direction. Right? And this is the problem, right? This is the difficulty, because the equation of radiative transfer is then not a single equation, but it's a huge set of equations for all directions in this room, right? Or in the universe, because you have to account for scattering from one direction into another direction. All right, so I think we can we can use the following relation that E and R plus TR and theta plus D theta can be developed as the Taylor expansion is the original I R theta plus D I over, it's a partial derivative, sorry, DI over DR and times DR plus partial DI over D theta times D theta. And then we shall use these geometrical relations. This is the left-hand side, this is the right-hand side. And because in all these terms, dx is present, we can cancel it. And the outcome is the partial derivative of I with respect to R times cosine theta minus, I see, there is a minus sign missing, sorry. There should be minus dx sine theta minus 1 over R sine theta di over d theta plus kappa rho I minus j rho equals to 0. And this is it. That's what I wanted to explain today, that the radiative transfer equation in spherical geometry looks like this. But as you see immediately, it's not very useful for us because we never want to work with these theta dependent quantities or even derivatives of di over d theta. Right? I would like to avoid this somehow, but it's not easy, right? It's not easy because in general, I is definitely theta dependent. So our way out is to introduce three more quantities, which are better for this description. Let me call them integral quantities, because they are integrals over the theta angle. And these quantities I'm going to use are defined as follows. It's the internal energy or the energy density. U, which is defined as 1 over C, the integral over the solid angle, which means over both theta and phi from the intensity, where this d omega is the solid angle element, or if you would like to specify it as a double integral, we shall always compute it as a double integral from d phi d theta sine theta. And I should have right here. So this is the energy density. Then we have the radiation flux, which is defined in a similar way. It's usually denoted as h, as an integral of I times cosine theta d omega, and radiative pressure, or P radiative, which is the integral of I cosine squared theta d omega. And it seems to me, I missed 1 over C factor here. These are very logical quantities, very useful quantities, because using these three quantities can be sufficient to avoid this potentially complex dependence of the intensity on theta. And first, of course, this is the first integral, or maybe it's better to say a zeroth integral of intensity, which describes the energy density, nothing else. Okay. This is the flux, right? It's the intensity multiplied by the cosine of theta. So it means that you multiply by this cosine dependence, which is positive for one direction and negative for the other direction, for the one R space and the other space. And so it's non-zero when this intensity changes substantially between these two major directions. And pressure, it's some different quantity. It's a radiative pressure, which is very useful for us, because in our state equation, radiative pressure is present. That's this quantity. And moreover, it can have very important dynamical effects when the radiative pressure gradient is present in the atmosphere. Okay, so I think it's already quite late. So let me conclude today that next week we are going to integrate the energy transfer equation twice. And we will substitute these integral quantities so that we obtain two variants of the energy of the radiative transfer equation. And then I hope to come up with a relation, which I'm going to describe here. I would like to obtain a relation of this type, a dt over dr. And that's something we are going to do next week, but dt over dr is the following. It's minus, because temperature gradient is negative. It's quite logical, right? We have high temperature in the center and atmosphere at the surface, so it should be a negative one. Then it's proportional to LR, to the amount of radiation which is present at a given distance, at a given radius. It's also proportional to kappa, and it's getting very logical dependence, right? Because kappa is an absorption coefficient, or the opacity. So the higher the kappa, the steeper is the gradient. Just imagine the situation in front of you, right? You have a very opaque layer in front of you. And of course, when the radiation is here, it cannot penetrate easily to the other side of the layer. And so the temperature gradient is steep. That's why it's proportional to kappa. And we always have to multiply by rho, because it's specific. And then it's also a factor of 3. It's not a key factor. And what about the denominator of this fraction? We should have here temperature, radius, and also some radiative quantities like A C. And because we work in spherical geometry, there's surely some vector of pi. And let me add also a numerical factor 16. But you know, these are not very important. It's important to understand why there are certain powers of R. It's R squared, the surface area. It's quite logical because, again, we work in spherical geometry and we work in shells. And T is to the power of 3. And this is probably not very intuitive. And we'll see it next week that why there is the power of 3. Essentially, it's related to this Planck function or the Stefan-Boltzmann law, where we have the power of 4, but we took a derivative. And that's why we obtain the power of 3 in the denominator. All right, so any questions or comments? If not, it was a long lecture. I'm sorry for this, but you know, sometimes it takes time for me to explain everything in detail, as I would like to wish. Sometimes students use a trick that they will play the lecture at higher speeds, and the top speeds I noticed is 3 times as fast as normal, which is kind of ridiculous. But you can try. Okay, see you next week, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
See you.
Goodbye.
Nice to see you. Goodbye.
Mohsen, jenom se ptát, nebo just Czech in or English?
Of course, you can ask in Czech a můžete se taky zeptat česky.
No, já jsem se jenom chtěl zeptat, bude teda tohleto na internetu, protože já to mám zároveň ještě jako s přednáškou z programování a ještě jako C++, teda ještě angličtinu k tomu mám, tak.
Já to samozřejmě dám na internet, akorát mám takový jako problém, že s tou minulou přednáškou já ji mám uloženou na nějakém jiném notebooku, ke kterému se teďka nedostanu. Ještě nám trhli přístup na pracoviště, což jsem jako skákal radostí do stropu, že jako
jo.
Nemůžu ani na to obvyklý přednáškový místnosti, takže já to potom všechno dám na internet. I to, co nebude nějaký problém, jo, že i kdybyste to propásl, tak to snad bude ke zhlédnutí později.
Jo, a ty první teda, no tu první teda tu asi, jo, takže na internet spíš později teda, až bude k dispozici i ta první.
No já to dám asi, tuhle tu až ji zpracuju, ono je potřeba jí malinko střihnout, jo, protože ona tam je třeba ta 10-minutová přestávka, tak to trošku střihnu a potom mi to trvá pár dní, než to tam jako nahraju. Příští týden by to už mělo být a k té první se dostanu snad za 14 dní, jo, to doufám, že do té Prahy dostanu.
No jo, a ta je nějaká, co vlastně v ní se probíralo, jestli se to dá třeba od někud doplnit, jako, že kdyby jste se tam dlouho třeba nedostal.
Jo, já jinak postupuju podle těch skript docela jako podobně, takže tu první přednášku můžete vlastně najít v těch skriptech jako kapitolu 1 a 3. Jo?
Mm-hmm.
To jsme stihli během té první přednášky, takže já myslím, že v těch skriptech, jo, student, který prostě je zorientovaný a který ví ty jako souvislosti, tak já myslím, že to můžete prodestovat docela rychle. Jo? Já mám pocit, že mně to trvá při tom výkladu mnohem díl, než když byste to jako rychle proletěl. Jo? Ale zase si říkám, ono, když se o tom jako podrobněji přemýšlí, třeba tady, že jsem nutil vaše kolegy, aby odhadovali opacitu v naší atmosféře, že právě tady tím jako provázáním s tím, co je okolo nás, jo, tak, že získám jako určitý cit pro to, co to znamená, co to je za veličinu, jo, že může být užitečná i pro naši atmosféru, tak dělám spíš takovýhle věci. Jo. V těch skriptech to myslím jako, tak, jako přímočaře a
jo.
Ty odkaz na ty skripte jsem vám posílal, víte, to jste dostal.
Ano. No to se mi právě moc líbilo, já jsem právě moc nemohl poslouchat, jenom jsem tak chvilkama slyšel, jak jste jako to různě tak jako... No prostě, že jste to vyprávěl tak, aby člověk získal i představu o tom nějakou, no.
No doufám, že jako nějaký cit proto se tím vypracuje, i když jsou to věci, že jo, na které jsme si jako nemohli sáhnout. Já jsem některý z nich viděl na vlastní oči jako v dalekohledu, jo, že s něčím jako jsem smířený, protože jsem tak to viděl, tak to to mám radost, ale ne vždycky to je ten případ, jo? Někdy jsou věci, o kterých člověk jenom četl, ale...
No tak, tak děkuju, když tak, no.
A uvidíte, jestli vám to vyjde příště, tak budu rád, když přijdete. A když ne, tak když tak ze záznamu. Mějte se zatím pěkně a...
Tak se mějte taky pěkně.
Naschledanou.
Děkuju. Naschledanou.